A grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of the Chancellor, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give and how your donations will help our community is on the web at www.ccfd.uiuc.edu.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL, AM 580, and online at WILL.uiuc.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Yankee Doodle, Jack Sprat, Georgie Porgy. What are the origins of these nursery rhymes? Many rhymes were born of religious and political strife. Many contain violent references and, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, sexual innuendo. I believe many of us have suspected that nursery rhymes have backstories, if you will. But what are they? On the program today, we're going to take a look at the meanings of nursery rhymes, past and present. Our guest is Chris Roberts. He is the author of Heavy Words, Lightly Thrown, The Reason Behind the Rhyme. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments about nursery rhymes for Chris Roberts. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Chris Roberts, is a librarian and the proprietor of South London's F&M Walking Tours. His book, Heavy Words, Lightly Thrown, began as a self-published project in Britain. It's now available in the U.S. from Gotham Books. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Chris Roberts, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Celeste.
Oh, nice to talk with you. This project grew out of your walking business. Would you tell us the story?
Yeah, I started looking into, well, the East of London Bridge, really, was the beginning point. Sometimes when you get children on the tours, it was a good idea to throw in something that they might relate to. So I gave them the origin of London Bridges Falling Down, which was a Norwegian poem originally about a man called King Olaf who towed away a wooden London bridge by attaching his ships to it, waiting for the tide and then pulling it down. And the original one goes, London Bridge is broken down, gold is won and bright renown, shield resounding, war horse sounding, Hilda shouting in the din. Hilda is one of those Norse gods that kind of fell out of favor when Christianity came around. But it sort of mutated over the centuries to be a celebration of the famous stone London Bridge that stood for 600 years. And that was very much on my walking tour beat, and I found several others. We have a rhyme, London's Burning, and the Monument to the Fire of London is very near London Bridge as well. So I just started adding these to my regular tours, and over time, I got interested in other nursery rhymes, ones that aren't London-based, if you like, more general ones, mm-hmm. Deviated off down there. So that's really how it all started.
Yeah. How is it that these rhymes that so often deal with, tough topics, death, cruelty, sex, how is it that they came to be nursery rhymes?
Well, some of them were deliberately written for children. I was giving information, even if it was harsh information. There's some terrible ones about warning children not to wet their bed. There's ones about an incident 400 years ago where a religious minority, an extreme fringy religious minority, tried to blow up parliaments called Remember, Remember the 5th of November. So those ones are telling stories that are still understandable today. What happened with some of the more, if you like, codified ones, things like Little Jack Horner, was that the meaning got scrambled as they were written up as collections towards the, certainly in the 18th century, but and again in the 19th century, and they began to be illustrated for children, and the covert meaning was lost, and the illustration went for a kind of direct interpretation. So you have a picture of Little Jack Horner sitting in a corner eating his Christmas pie, and you have a picture of a man with the pie, and yet what it's actually about is the acquisition of some property during the reign of Henry VIII, and the coded meaning's gone, but the image of the man with the pie remains. So they crossed over, some of them, from an adult side to children's side as they were written up.
Yeah. Well, your book, Little Jack Horner, is where you begin with the rhymes themselves. And I would say that this rhyme tells the story of a white-collar theft, if you would. And also, apparently, Little Jack Horner was the man who was this rhyme was based on was also quite the climber, upgrading wives every few years.
Oh, no, that was the man who gave him the property who did that. But he was, it's a very good description. I wish I'd thought of that, the white-collar crime. Essentially, what his name was actually Thomas Horner. What happened to him was he was asked to deliver some properties to King Henry VIII, who's the man who liked to upgrade his wives. And in one version, Thomas Horner steals one set of title deeds to a place called Mell's Manor. A more likely interpretation is that when he delivered the deeds to Henry VIII, the king gave him or sold him the Mell's Manor very, very cheaply, and it was a means for the king to raise money. It was also a means to establish political support for what the king was doing. So these were up-and-coming Protestant gentry who were taking advantage of the fact that land was being taken from the Catholic Church. So it's a very modern tale of gentrification, mm-hmm. I think.
Sorry about that. I got my characters royally screwed up there.
Which is pretty much what Henry did most of the time.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting that Thomas Horner's descendants have another take on the story. They say their ancestor paid fair and square.
Yeah, they would say that. I mean, I think he paid for it, but I think he paid a very small amount for it, just on the research. Last time anybody checked, they were still living there. This is, nearly 400 years on. His descendants still live in Mell's Manor, apparently. So it's a very lovely property. So they've hung on to it and kept it there. But that's the sort of thing that happens with the rhymes, that the rhyme would originally have been a Catholic rhyme criticizing the Protestant ascendancy in England, and a lot of these rhymes do seem to go back to a 200-year period where there's scrapping between Protestants and Catholics as to who should be king, who should be running the country, and many of them seem to be born from that. And because people were less free to say what they like at that time, some of them were written in a slight code.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Sing a Song of Sixpence, then.
Oh, we're back to... That's Henry VIII as well.
Yeah.
It's actually the same... It's alluding to the same incident. Although the end bit's quite interesting with the two... Well, one's out. One of his wives, Catherine of Aragon, is out in the parlour, and the other one, his second wife, Anne Boleyn, is represented as the maid who gets her nose snipped off by blackbirds. When in real life, of course, she was executed by a specially brought in French executioner who specialised in executing women, apparently, which is an odd career choice to have, but nevertheless, that was. I can't imagine asking for that at the job centre today, but in those days, they were in much demand.
Now, who would have recited such a rhyme at the time?
They would have been adults primarily, and some of them start life as, if you like, tavern songs. But there's another thing to bear in mind, which is this division that we have today, and has been going on for nearly 200 years now, of children's entertainment and adult entertainment is not really established 300 or 400 years ago, that children, you couldn't really shield children from adult sights, and children were very much regarded as young adults. Mm-hmm. You know, that classic Dickensian thing of sending little boys up chimneys at very early ages. Children would go out to work and earn their money, so they would be almost treated like little adults. So this idea that they would have separate songs for themselves doesn't really come about until nearly 200 years ago, where you get this division of childhood, if you like, and adulthood. The idea comes in that they're split off.
Yeah.
So in answer to your question, sorry, it's right about what you're saying, anybody would have sung them, I think. It's probably a fair response.
Yeah. Well, would these rhymes in some sense been equivalent to our Daily Show in the U.S.? I mean, a way for people to communicate with one another quickly and humorously and with some digs?
Certainly. I mean, because we've got so many mediums today. We have radio and TV and the internet, and these would be very much social commentary. If I may add a slightly risque one in, I know it's lunchtime with you, but Rub-a-dub-dub, three men in a tub, and who do you think were there? The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, and all jumped out of a rotten potato. It was enough to make a man stare. This is a slightly, although it's a slightly strange version, it's actually a bolderized version of an earlier rhyme that went, rub-a-dub-dub, three maids in a tub, and who do you think were there? The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, and all of them gone to the fair. And this is classic. I mean, I could have picked up a newspaper today at my local newsstand that would have a tale of respectable people caught out at a lap dancing club, and that essentially is what this rhyme's about. It's about these bourgeois tradesfolk at a sideshow, at a fair sideshow, ogling some naked young ladies. That's the basis of Rub-a-dub-dub. So, yes, they would very much convey information, whether satirical or more pointed. That was definitely one of their functions.
Kind of like a verbal graffiti.
Yes, is the way. It would hand down through generations. There would be local variants on these things as well, which is why you get many different versions of some of them. Tying it into a local character rather than a national one, if you like.
They have
long longevity on their side.
Yeah. So they often morphed.
Yeah, very much. I mean, you alluded to Yankee Doodle earlier on, mm-hmm. and there's I could have written a whole book on Yankee Doodle. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of versions, either written by the Americans or Canadians or British, often conflicting with each other. But it was essentially a popular dance tune. It's a bit like somebody in Chicago comes up with a new kind of dance music. Very swiftly, somebody in Manchester nicks the tune and reworks it and redoes the lyrics and then sends it back to Chicago, and you get this kind of back and forth. Yankee Doodle's a good early example of that. And it was, in fact, a dance tune originally. There's a lovely variant that goes, Yankee Doodle, keep it up, Yankee Doodle dandy, mind the music and the step, and with the girls be handy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reminder that there were slightly different dance steps in the US and Europe at the time, so the chap better be a bit careful with the lady in case he treads on her toes. It's just a slight warning.
So yeah.
But it's a nice one, Yankee Doodle. I like the fact that the Americans turned it on the British, even though it was originally a British song. It's a nice bit of irony and comic timing. They played it at Bunker Hill. It's good. But the original, the most popular surviving lyric, that Yankee Doodle comes to town riding on a pony, stuck a feather in his cap, called it macaroni, was a British version alluding to a youth group called the Macaronis, who were kind of like New Romantics, if you can remember those from the 1980s, very, very dandified young men about London who spent hours getting ready. And the essence of the rhyme is that it takes more than putting a feather in your cap to become a macaroni. It takes a lot harder to achieve the look, if you like. So that's two of the versions.
Now today, if I was with you in London and we went out on the street and we asked somebody to recite Yankee Doodle, would it be the same Yankee Doodle that we recite here in the U.S.
What's the version that you do?
It was the one that you gave us. Yankee Doodle came to town riding on a pony, stuck a feather in his cap and called it Macaroni. And then also there's the dance. That's what I also recall.
We don't have the dance. How does the step go?
I don't know.
This is radio,
well,
isn't it?
It's not so much I know what the dance is, but it is, you know, on, you know, be nimble, which reminds me of another nursery rhyme.
This is Jack from Chapman. Yeah. In answer to your question, yes, people would. That is the version that we know here. That is the most popular one that we know. Because there's somewhere there are slight variations between collections that were printed in America and collections that were printed here. But no, that one's the same. You were going to be nimble, weren't you? You were going to jump across. Jack, be nimble. Jack, be quick. Jack jumped over a candlestick. It's a really lovely story. It's about fortune telling. It's going back to pagan fire jumping. And the idea is that if you can jump over a candle, some people, they practice it on New Year. And some places, Buckinghamshire, I think it's November the 25th, and St. Catherine, the patron saint of weave makers, or... Anyway, they jumped over, and the idea was that if you could jump over the candle without putting out the flame, that was a good thing. That was a positive thing for the new year. I suggest in the book that it's just to do with weight loss and fitness, and if you have the ability and strength to jump over the candle without putting out the flame, then you're probably quite fit, and you'll probably be working for the next year quite safely. But that could just be me misinterpreting it. But the essence of it is a... as a means of telling a future.
Yeah. Well, what challenges did researching these rhymes pose for you?
Massive, because there's been some very good academic work on nursery rhymes, which I've drawn on. There's also been an incredible amount of, if you like, urban legend making about them. The English Satanist Aleister Crowley wrote a book, I think it's 1898, on the occult meanings of nursery rhymes. And about 5 years later, he announced to the world that this was a hoax. It was a very clever hoax, but nevertheless, it was a hoax. And, of course, all those theories are out there, and they have to be disproved. They have to be knocked down. So that was some of the things. And I would find stories that I would really love to have put in the book that are just patently not true, which is a real shame, because they were, at one time I was going to have an appendix at the back of, if you like, incorrect stories because they were amusing, but I've run out of space to do it. So that was a big problem.
Next edition, maybe, huh?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, it's a lovely book. I would think it's going to do or is doing very well.
I hope so.
Yeah.
It's funny having the American edition with the glossary in the back. I think that there are perhaps too many terms in there. I think most Americans would understand that we call the tube the we call the subway the tube, but
we call the tube the television. So not only are there differences, but they can be wildly different. But the glossary is great fun.
I think some of them are very good. I had real trouble translating the English term copping off with, which means when you meet somebody and you're not quite in a relationship with them, but you're not maybe at first base, I think might be the American equivalent. It's a very English term. But some of the words are very particular to where I live now in Southeast London. The word sort for babe, I think, is unique to Southeast London. And the word woollybach is unique to Liverpool, which is where I'm from, to describe people who are from the suburbs, from outside of the city. So I think some explanation was necessary. But,
have to call in the language boffins.
Yes.
Now explain what a boffin is.
A boffin is, I think you use the term egghead. It's somebody who's a bit too much of an expert on something that nobody else is really interested in. Somebody who's obsessed with the design of windows on double-decker buses, for example, might be described as a boffin. to pick a recent example here. They're phasing out the double-decker buses in London, for those who don't know. It's a real shame.
Yeah.
Loss. But, that's no nursery rhymes about that. That's a bit too modern.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Chris Roberts. He's the author of Heavy Words Lightly Thrown, The Reason Behind the Rhyme. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. I invite your questions and comments about nursery rhymes for our guest, Chris Roberts. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Chris Roberts is a librarian, and he is the proprietor of South London's F&M Walking Tours. And you can find him online at fandmpublications.co.uk. And if you don't have a pencil at the moment, well, you can join us on our website, and there's a link to Chris Roberts there on our site as well. I want to go back to the question of, you know, who was reciting these rhymes at the time, and I want to follow up with this question. Were the subjects of these rhymes, you know, it could be the king, it could be the church, very powerful institutions, were the subjects of these rhymes aware of them?
The people reciting rhymes would hope not, but
right.
In the incident, if they were challenged, they would just say, "Well, no, this is a rhyme. I've got Jack, thinking of Jack Sprat could eat no fat, his wife could eat no lean." Now, allegedly, that's about King Charles I of England, but if the king's men challenged anybody singing that, they would say, "No, it's about a man called Jack Sprat. Of course, it's about a man called Jack Sprat and his wife." And so they would be, I don't think anybody was executed for reciting nursery rhymes, if you like, even though some of them are, some of them talk about people being executed for different, for three blind mice as an association with owning the Bible in English, which became a crime during the time of Mary Tudor. So although they might allude to people being punished, there's no record of anybody actually being punished for reading nursery rhymes. Although, interestingly, in England in the 70s, I say early 80s, some local authorities tried to ban Bar Bar Black Sheep on the grounds that it might promote racial prejudice, which is strange because it's actually about taxation. But that's a complete deviation of the subject of punishment. So people wouldn't... I don't think anyone was punished for these rhymes because they were. There's no authorship to them. They're anonymous. They're folk songs, if you like, telling little stories or telling how life is. And it would be very hard to find the original person who wrote them.
Yeah. Like, so. Yeah, we're back to that idea of graffiti.
We are, yes. Yeah. It's anonymous. Although some graffiti people like to. Like to make it clear that they've done it, but this is all pre-copyright, which is probably why nursery rhymes in the future will be very different, because there aren't many avenues of copyright-free song out there. We have football chants in the soccer chants, rather, in England. I'm not sure of the American equivalent, perhaps some songs that are sung in playgrounds, children's games, whatever.
Yeah.
But I don't think... People are very keen to claim credit for their work now. So if somebody was writing a collection of nursery rhymes, they'd probably say, "This is my collection of nursery rhymes," which doesn't work in quite the same way.
Yeah. Well, the idea...
access to them.
Yeah, the... on playgrounds in the U.S. and in parks where children skip rope, there are lots of rhymes.
That's right, yeah. It's sort of rhyming games. So if some of those survive into the future... Or even, I mean, strange things like advertising jingles. If a company goes, the company ceases to exist, but the jingle is remembered, that's another odd route in the future. But I don't know where they're going to come from. But in the past, they were just anonymously written things sung, not even written down necessarily, but sung and passed through the community.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener. We've got a caller waiting for us in Chicago on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm enjoying the show. Can you comment, Chris, on Jack and Jill? Was that an actual torture, or was that adultery, or I'd heard several different things.
I hadn't heard of the torture one, but the adultery thing you're nearer the mark on. There's two associations here. One is with a Norse legend, a Scandinavian legend about a young couple going up to the top of the hill on May Day to collect dew for the fertility ritual the next day for the dancing around the maypole. And from a psychological reading of nursery rhymes, a book called Cradle Will Fall, is the association that it's actually a warning about premarital sex. It's a warning about this young couple going up to the top of the hill for the falling down and breaking crown, suggesting loss of virginity. And interestingly, there's an extra verse that isn't often in it, with Jill coming down and laughing at what's happened to Jack, and Jill being punished by her mother. So that's the association I have in the book from I'll say from the psychological reading of nursery rhymes and from Norse legend. So torture implements, no, but sexual practice, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've got another question about Ring Around the Rosie. I heard that was to do with the plague.
In the book, what I did was if a rhyme exists around the time of what it's supposed to be talking about, so Jack Sprat and Charles I, there's a strong possibility that it's about that. The problem with Ring Around the Roses, which is that the rhyme doesn't come about until quite some time after the last plague outbreak in Europe, but the idea of plague is so hardwired into the European consciousness, I think in a way that it isn't in America, because there was never the devastation, that you can't prove that it isn't about the Black Death. But I should tell you the alternative theory, which is that it's a means, and this is a popular explanation in America and also some parts of England, that it's a means of getting round a ban on dancing by the Puritan church authorities. It's by making the rhyme a children's rhyme and having a little dance with it. It allowed children at least to dance, whereas the church authorities in strict Puritan communities wouldn't allow adults to. So that's that's the unsinister side of it, if you like. But I can't prove that one either way, and I really, it's the only one in the whole book that I leave hanging, because so many people believe it's about the Black Death. It's the one that everybody knows, and I think that's for a reason. I think there's something deep in our psyche that...
very interesting. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other questions are invited. You can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon, Chris Roberts, author of Heavy Words, Lightly Thrown, The Reason Behind the Rhyme. In Ring a Ring o' Roses, which we know here in the U.S. is Ring Around the Rosies, something like that, I think.
Similar.
Yeah, it's a little different, but it was also interesting to learn that there are regional English versions of the rhyme that suggest the falling down is more of a curtsy.
Yeah, it was part of the dance
uh-huh.
step. That would be a part of it. So it's a dropping down onto your knee, if you like, or if you're a gentleman, or curtsying if you're a young lady. So there are these associations with innocent dance, as well as the more macabre one with the Black Death. But it does have several different slight variations. There's the most popular one is Pocket, Ring a Ring of Roses, Pocket Full of Posies, a tissue, we all fall down. There is a version that runs ashes, we all fall down. So many of these were rewritten and over the centuries and actually picked up different meanings through time. Grand Old Duke of York was originally the brave old King of France, had 40,000 men marching up the top of the hill. And a journalist in 1820 took that rhyme and then changed it to the Grand Old Duke of York and used it as a means of satirizing the Duke of York at the time, who'd been a bit ineffective in fighting in Flanders in northeast Europe. So, northwest Europe. So there are these rhymes that have a meaning, and they pick up different ones as they go through their life. Humpty Dumpty being a prime example of that.
Now, what's that rhyme?
Well, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. Now, the real origin seems to be a warning about behavior, about there are some actions that you take and you must live with the consequences. You must be careful how you behave, because the consequences will not be something you can fix again, hence the metaphor of the egg smashing, which are really tricky to do if you've ever tried to pull them back together again. And then it kind of moves. It's by the 14th century. It's an ale and brandy-based drink, or later on it comes to describe a clumsy person of either sex. So this phrase, Humpty Dumpty, is in the language. And there's an odd association during our Civil War. The term Humpty Dumpty came to be a nickname for a cannon on the walls of that city called Colchester. And the cannon was being defended by the king's men during the Civil War. The opposing side managed to knock the cannon off the wall, whereupon it shattered, because their cast iron things are quite brittle. And there you get a perfect bit for the ending of the rhyme, that all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. So you have this rhyme that's moving, if you like, because it's part of the language, it's part of the culture, and different associations get picked up throughout history.
Yeah. When I was reading Heavy Words Lightly Thrown, Rap's lyrics came to mind. They rhyme, and also unless you're in the know, you might not know what the rapper is rapping about.
Yeah, that's very true. There's a rhyme that goes, I don't know if you know how popular it is in America, Seesaw Marjorie Daw, starts like that, which is normally illustrated as a young lady on a seesaw going up and down, and it's quite a cheerful light rhyme. But until the 18th century, the word door meant slut or slattern. So what you have is a rhyme that actually starts up and down, goes Marjorie the slattern, which completely twists the meaning of the rhyme. Which is the same, because I listen to bands today, and I don't always understand the reference. I understand that there is a reference sometimes, that there's something else being said, but I can't always follow it.
Yeah.
We have the same difficulty with the word goose.
Goosey-goosey gander?
Goosey-goosey gander. Well, just the phrase mother goose, which we know in this country, but we don't really apply, because the term goose once meant prostitute here, and that, I think, has rather changed any association with Mother Goose. So a lot of it is just to do with words changing their meaning over the centuries, which happens in our own life. I like the phrase. I think in 50 years' time, there's a phrase that I see in gangster films, to put a cap in someone, meaning to shoot them, which is, in 50 years' time, somebody could look at that and just think, well, no, you don't put a cap in someone. You put a cap on someone. That makes no sense. And they will translate it as to put a cap on someone, which is to congratulate somebody, and the whole meaning of the phrase changes. And this is the sort of thing that's happened with many of the rhymes. One of the most useful books I used in researching this was just the Oxford English Dictionary, I'm looking back at the changing meaning of terms.
Yeah. Well, I think now, we talked a little bit earlier about macaroni and who the macaronis were. I believe there is a rap lyric about, I would guess it would be a rapper describing a contemporary macaroni and describing jewelry in the grill, which is...
Is that mouth? Is that jewelry in the mouth?
Yeah, jewelry.
I know, I'm guessing.
You know, it's like a gem attached to the teeth.
That's fantastic. That's a great phrase. That's a really good phrase.
Yeah, a lot of wonderful creative stuff out there, but I need some help.
No, I know.
Deciphering
I need some
it.
Translation.
I am not in the know.
But it is a very and it's a good analogy actually about music. It's a very good analogy with nursery rhymes in some ways, because they are talking in code about adult things that isn't immediately accessible to a broader community.
Hmm.
And the key difference is, though, I guess what I said before, is that they will probably have copyrighted that phrase, unlike the nursery rhyme writers. You know? I think they'd be quite cross if somebody nicked
Although it's bound to be sampled somewhere, I'm
sure.
Yes.
Well, somebody in Manchester is probably doing it now, in fact. It's just that's what they do.
Just open the window there.
Yeah.
The rhyme that so many of us know, I think you say we one that everyone knows, ring a ring of roses, a ring around the rosies, what I learned it as growing up.
Yeah.
The meaning of that, other than the fun of it and the dance of it, was totally lost on me as a kid. I had no idea what it was all about, but it was a fun thing to circle around with one's friends and then crash to the ground. Humpty Dumpty is, you know, you could, as a child, whether it was maybe taking care of your toys or taking care of when you were on your tricycle, it makes sense.
I think because one of the things I've spoken to people a lot about this, and one, it's strange how children do respond to them. Like, you're absolutely right, actually. Humpty Dumpty does kind of make sense as a literal rhyme, and some of them do. But what surprised me was that people often are frightened by rhymes that I always thought was completely innocuous. There's one that goes, "It's raining, it's pouring, the old man is snoring, he went to bed and bumped his head and didn't get up in the morning," which I thought was just... I don't know, quite a ribald rhyme about just a man having a nice time, slightly hurting himself and taking a day off work. And I spoke to this one gentleman. No, this is really, that was all right. I didn't think too much about it. But I thought, this one gentleman thought it was terrible that he'd bumped his head and the man had clearly died, and was disturbed throughout his childhood by this particular rhyme. So aside from the, if you like, the obvious meanings that you're encouraged to look at because of the illustration, and the illustrations do play a big part in how these rhymes lost their meaning, and the ones that you can make some sort of sense of, like you said with Humpty Dumpty, that children will often pluck out meanings that are just personal to them, and in some ways quite disturbing, even in the like that one, even the more innocuous ones. So it is strange how they do seem to evoke something.
Yeah. Well, the rhyme about the old man who bumped his head and couldn't get up in the morning. When I was a kid, I just thought that was something like, you know, slapstick.
Yes.
Punch and Judy or the Three Stooges.
That's how I saw it. I just saw it as comic, and I was really disturbed by this.
He's
over it now. He's in his 30s by now. He was definitely over it, but he had some difficult years. Very strange. The odd what people pick out of them. And What I've tried to do is obviously pick out the better historical stories and put them into a kind of context as well, put them into a modern day context, so people can disassociate from their childhood, if you like, and look at them in an adult way.
Yeah.
I'm particularly fond of Georgie Porgy, which I think you mentioned earlier, which I wanted to believe so much was about the Uncle George Villiers, the gay lover of our King James the First, and I so wanted it to be about that, but unfortunately it isn't. It's a much more, in a sense, modern rhyme about it's about childhood obesity. It's almost a government health warning.
You're kidding?
No, it's basically, don't put on too much weight, you'll scare the girls away. It's just that. Very. The original version is roly poly pudding and pie. not Georgie Porgie. It's Roly Poly.
That rings a bell from my childhood.
What, the pudding, the
pudding, yeah, the Roly Poly pudding and pie.
So I was disappointed in that, but at least I could draw some modern parallel from it. If you like,
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Earlier you mentioned that you, in the course of researching these, you ran across a lot of great stories, but they were not true about the origins of these rhymes. Among them, if you had to pick out one that was not true but a great story, what would it be?
I can't like the Georgie Porgie one, but there's one about a pussycat going to London to visit the Queen, and it's quite a long verse, but it's supposed to be about some cat visiting Queen Elizabeth I, which is complete nonsense. The other one I quite like is, "Hey diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle, the cow jumped over the moon, little devil laughed to see such fun, and something ran away with a spoon." And this is from Crowley, the Satanist, who just came up with this whole thing about it being a dog star and to do with blood sacrifices and the Egyptian pantheon of Osiris and whatever. And he concocted this whole theory about the Egyptian gods and the pharaohs linked into this rhyme. I think that's probably the most involved and complex one, but sadly not true at all. Just something he came up with.
What rhyme posed the greatest difficulty to decipher?
I'd have to go back to "Ring a Ring of Roses" because it's the only one that I leave absolutely. That and "Merry Merry Can't Contrary."
Yeah,
I leave that one kind of undecided as well. Because it can't be proved either way, and I would like "Merry Merry Quite Contrary" to be about Mary Tudor, but I don't. I suspect it probably isn't, but it probably is about gardening, which is slightly disappointing considering all the possibilities there. But "Ring a Ring of Roses" is definitely the hardest to unpick, because in the end you just come up with a blank wall. It's either about children's dancing, or it's about the extermination of a third of the population of Europe, which is quite it's quite a thing to bridge, a thing to get across.
"Merry, merry, quite contrary, how does your garden grow?
Grow
with silver bells and cockle shells and pretty maids all in a row?"
The theory is that the pretty maids all in a row are to do with Mary Queen of Scots and her court and her love of shiny things. And the other theory is about Mary Tudor and the silver bells and cockle shells. There you've got your euphemism for torture implements. And the pretty maids are actually the widowed husbands of people she's had executed. So that's the two theories to do with Mary, Mary, quite contrary. But the rhyme doesn't come into existence until sometime later. So it's suspect, unfortunately. And do you have a favorite rhyme yourself? Do you?
I would have to go back to Yankee Doodle.
Yeah, it's a nice one.
Yeah, it's a merry one, and there's something so deliciously rebellious about it. That's why I like it. I wanted to ask you, speaking of Mary, Queen of Scots, and Mary Tudor, are you familiar with the game that kids play in the dark in front of a mirror? Mary.
Yeah, it's to do. There's a movie called The Candyman that I think plays on this urgent urban legend. You mustn't say Bloody Mary in front of the mirror. Is it three times?
Three times.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't know the origin of that. I mean, I'm interested in whether the drink's named after her, and we have a card game called Bloody Mary as well in this country, which goes by a number of other names. And there does seem to be this kind of going back to this character of Mary as a bit of a one, as we say.
It makes you wonder, you know, how many other, you know, what have the spin-offs been?
Of the Mary franchise. Yeah. Yeah. Did she invest in it? I don't know. Did she own a card factory? If possible. I don't know.
We have a beverage. We have an urban legend.
And a card game.
And
potentially, well, definitely a nursery rhyme in Three Blind Mice, and possibly another one with Mary. She laid down tracks for the future. Now, she could have copyrighted it. She could have done really well. Fantastic on that. Whether she'd have had to sue the person who Mary had a little lamb, which comes along later, whether there'd have been copyright action there, I don't know. That's because the names are quite interesting in nursery rhymes. Jill tends to represent every woman, and Jack tends to represent every man, particularly if he's a bit dodgy, particularly if he's a bit shady. You get this name Jack coming up all the time, and obviously. The end of the 19th century, you have Jack the Ripper. You could not have had Brian the Ripper. It wouldn't have worked in the same way. There seems to be a semiotics is the wrong word, but there seems to be name associations, and Jack and Jill are the most popular throughout nursery rhymes. With Mary, I'd say running about third on this particular one. But Mary had the brains to branch out, obviously. Yeah. This is the thing.
The time is up.
I'm sorry.
I am too. It's been a delight talking with you this afternoon. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Chris Roberts has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Look for his book, Heavy Words Lightly Thrown, The Reason Behind the Rhyme. The book's available in the U.S. from Gotham Books, and you can find Chris Roberts online at fandmpublications.co.uk. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Just when you think it couldn't get any quieter at the Chicago Board of Trade, it went and did. Most contracts trading under 1,000 in volume on the day. Corn goes in a narrow 3/4 cent trading range. New contract lows in the lead month December contract as well. Some buying support in the commercial vein supported hard red winter wheat markets. The Chicago higher on non-commercial short covering, of course, on Wednesday morning. We're waiting from USDA for their latest crop production numbers. And the anticipation is that the numbers will go up significantly from the September report. Let's go ahead and look at the current settlements for you. And we start in the wheat pit. December wheat, a high on the day, a 341 and a quarter, a low of 338 and a quarter, settling 339 and three quarters, up 1 3/4. March, a high of 355 and a quarter, a low of 352 and a quarter, settling 354, up 1 1/2. May, a high of 362, a low of 359 and three quarters, settling 361 and a half, up 1 1/2. July, a high of 368 and a quarter, a low of 365 and three quarters, settling 367 and a quarter, up 2. September, a high of 374, a low of 371 and a half, settling 373 and a quarter, up 1 3/4. December corn, a high of 202 and three quarters, a low of 201 and three quarters, settling 202. That's a contract low, down a half. March, a high of 215 and a half, a low of 214 and a half, settling 214 and three quarters, down three quarters. May, a high of 223 and a quarter, a low of 222 and three quarters, settling 223, down a half. July, a high of 230 and a half, a low of 229 and a half, settling 229 and three quarters, down three quarters. September, a high of 237, a low of 236 and a half, settling 236 and a half, down three quarters. December, the red line, a high of 246 and three quarters, a low of 245 and a half, settling 245 and three quarters, down one on the day. December oats, a high of 167, a low of 163 and a half, settling 165, down three. March, a high of 172, a low of 170, settling 171 and a quarter, down 1 1/4. November soybeans, a high of 561.5, a low of 554.5, settling at 555.5, down 8.75. January, a high of 573, a low of 566, settling 568.5, down 7.5. March, a high of 581, a low of 574, settling 575.25, down 8.5. May, a high of 585.5, a low of 580, settling on the low, down 9.25. July beans, a high of 591.5, a low of 585, settling 585.25, down 8.75. August, a high of 588.5, a low of 585, settling on the low, down 10 on the day. October soybean meal, a high of 164.50, a low of 163.10, settling 164.30, down a dollar. December, a high of 168, a low of 166.10, settling 166.60, down $2. October soybean oil, a high of 23.45, a low of 23.05, settling 23.07, down 40. The December, a high of 23.70, a low of 23.25, settling 23.26, down 40 on the day. Settlement prices also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where it was a mixed day in cattle, Celeste.
That's right. Live cattle finished higher today, while feeders were lower. Lean hogs also finished lower, and February bellies finished down $1.25. October feeder cattle, the high today, 118.50, the low 117.80, the settlement 118 even, that down 32.5. November, 116.95, the high 116.15, the low 116.40, the settlement, that down 25. January feeder cattle, 114.05, the high 113.20, the low 113.82.5, the settlement, that unchanged. October live cattle, 91 even the high, 90 even the low, 90.80 the settlement, that up 55. December, 91.65 the high, 90.87.5 the low, 91.40 the settlement, that up 30. October lean hog, 68.60 the high, 68.20 the low, 68.32.5 the settlement, that down 22.5. December, 65.40, the high, 64.45, the low, 64.52.5, the settlement, that down 50. February, lean hog, 68.05, the high, 67.45, the low, 67.55, the settlement, that down 45. April, lean hog, 67.10, the high, 66.40, the low, 66.55, the settlement, that down 50. And February, pork bellies, 98.15, the high, 96.20, the low, 96.45, the settlement, that down 102.5. The Dow is down 27 points at 10,265. The NASDAQ off 8 at 2082. The S&P 500 7 points lower at 1189.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Bezdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Henry Frain is our technical director today. The Afternoon Magazine is produced by Harriet Williamson. My name is Celeste Quinn.